The Golden Dome. President Trump promised Americans not long ago that we would have this amazing shield that's impenetrable by any kind of defense or any kind of offensive missile that could come at the United States. Any kind of nuclear missile, cruise missile, you name it, they said. And they literally said it. Don't worry, we got it. The technology is there and we are safe. Here this past just a little over a week or a month or so ago, there was a new movie out called A House of Dynamite. And in this, it depicts what would happen if a nuclear attack against the United States actually had, what would be the decision-making process, et cetera. It was a terrifying movie, very, very realistically done. There was this particular scene in there, though, where one particular missile was coming in, and it was going to be intercepted by a ground-based interceptor, a GBI, as they call it in the movie. And we were told during the process of this, it was had a, only a 61% chance of interception. And the one of the main characters in the movie blasted one of the analysts and said, "You're telling me it's basically a coin flip? That's the best that we've got?" And everyone was really afraid of that. Well, as it turns out, MIT professor Ted Postol was watching that movie, and he had a bit of a bone to pick with that. And he mentioned it the last time we were on the show, and we asked him to come back and tell us what is the real story, Golden Dome or not, or whatever the current situation is. How protected would we be? And he's back with us to do exactly that today, about the no kidding real defense capability we have from ballistic missiles that may be coming in. Professor, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on the show here. Let me just make a comment, due to some things that you and Gary just showed me. There were two reviews, one from The New Yorker and the other from The Guardian. And my reaction to it is the people who know nothing or the people who say bad things about this film. I think this film is an excellent film. It's obviously an attempt to dramatize what could happen if there was an attack. And I do think that it does an excellent job dramatizing it. There are details that anyone can argue with, but they really aren't relevant. Some aspects of the scenario that was chosen, all of the scenarios are implausible. What happens is something implausible is going to happen and you're going to have a World War III. So this wisdom that these people snidely talk about is, they really have none. They really don't understand what they're talking about. And I'm a little offended by the snide way that this film was attacked. It's quite good. It dramatizes the helplessness of the people in these decision-making situations, if in fact there were a real attack. And it does an excellent job capturing the sequence of events and the inability of the people in any position where they're supposed to be doing something to do anything at all. And I think that's correct. And the emotional sense of desperation that the film portrays is exactly what I would expect to see. I worked in the Pentagon. I know people who would have been involved in these kinds of operations. I know what they understood, not what they followed bureaucratically. I mean, many conversations with people who are involved in these things who understood that if there was an attack of this kind, the world would end. And they had no illusions about it, even though they were expected to behave as if it was something that could be done. So this film is a very good rendition of what actually happened. Now, what the film does is it tries very hard to accurately use information that was available to it. And so this is not a criticism of the film. This is a criticism of the information that's provided to the public. And in the particular case of the film, they assume that a missile defense, that our missile defense, our ground-based missile defense, known as the GMD, fires on this single warhead that is coming in. And the Secretary of Defense in the film is told that the Interceptor has a 61%, two decimal places. It's really interesting. 61% a chance of hitting the warhead. I can tell you where that 61% chance comes from. And I'm going to explain in the next few minutes why it's total nonsense. In fact, the number is a fraud. Now, I want to underscore here that this has nothing to do with the filmmakers. This has to do with what the filmmakers were told by people who have no idea what they're talking about, who are in the system and who thought they were giving them accurate information. In fact, an honest, careful guess of what the intercept probability is would be zero. And I'm going to explain why that. And you should, if I do the job well, you will understand why the number is absolutely and almost certainly would be zero. So, let me start at slide three. I just want to use the words on the slide to cue my. First of all, the Missile Defense Agency has been implementing a fraud for decades on this whole missile defense program. It's the Missile Defense Agency. Of course, the civilian oversight of the Missile Defense Agency is ultimately responsible for allowing this fraud to go forward and for continuing to spend tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of national treasure on a system that cannot do anything. And I'm quite, speaking in such absolute terms, I've thought about it, and I'll show you what's behind my thoughts. One of the things that, having been involved in unraveling several frauds in the past, one of the things you learn about frauds is that those involved in the fraud, they try to divert your attention to things that aren't relevant, things that they can create the sense that there's a debate to be had. So in this particular sense, they talk about the success rate of the rigged tests. And I'm talking about rigged tests. These tests are rigged, as I'll show you. So they're not real tests. And by looking at this, by diverting you to the wrong question, which is how many of these rigged tests hit a target, rather than why are the tests rigged and how are they rigged, they try to create the sense that there's a debate to be had about the performance of this system. As I'll show you, there is no debate. There's none at all. So in the case of the ground-based missile defense, all of these tests are rigged. And I'll give you, for example, they claim an effectiveness. They're trying to claim an effectiveness of 100% now, because what they're doing is they say they hit targets in the four last tests. And because they hit targets in the four last tests, it means the system is now working. That's the argument. As I'll show you, the system is not working and it has never worked. So what they're trying to conceal is that the rigging of the tests somehow is not there. And in fact, whenever the rigged tests don't work as planned, when the rigging is not exactly as they intend it to be, the tests fail catastrophically. And I'll show you that.
And by the way, I just want to show on this screen here, for any of you may be wondering, this is from this is from 2014 here. But they talk about how the U.S. conducts successful missile interceptor tests in the Pacific. So this just shows you that this is official statements here, that that's exactly what we're being told.
Yeah, that's what you're being told. So let me let's go to slide five just to focus people on what I'm talking about. Let me first spend a couple of slides talking about how the missile defense works so you can understand how it's being rigged. In the next slide, what we see is a cartoon of how the system works. So basically, if you look to your middle right, there's an early warning radar. The radar searches the sky for an incoming warhead. The radar then estimates where the warhead is going. This makes it possible for a much less powerful radar, in this case it's called the ground or sea-based radar, to search a much smaller area of sky because it's not capable of searching at long enough range a big area of sky. It then acquires the target. This is according to the people who tell you the system is running, tracks the target in detail, and then manages the launch of interceptors to fly toward the target and hit them and destroy the target. So let's look in the next slide about what are the targets we're talking about. Since we're, so what are the targets to be intercepted? Let's go to the next slide. Here we have my good friend, General Kadish, who I'll show you, lied to the American people. This is a lieutenant general who knowingly lied to the American people about a system that's supposed to defend the country from the mortal effects of a nuclear attack. So this three-star general, I'll leave it for you to find the name for him, but this is a guy who knew what he was talking about, as I'll show you. Next to General Kadish is a warhead, which is the kind of warhead that they're shooting at. And next to the warhead is the kill vehicle, which they are using to hit the warhead. And they're claiming right now 100% intercept rate because the last four tests hit a target. If we go to the next slide, we get a sense of what the kill vehicle actually is. In the upper yellow background, the kill vehicle is shown. It has rocket motors that point perpendicular to the direction of its movement. And those rocket motors, there are four of them, move the kill vehicle laterally, left or right, and up or down. So there's a small amount of propulsion. And the kill vehicle, if we look below, has a telescope in it. And the telescope has a large reflecting mirror, shown in green at the back, which collects the infrared signal from a distant warhead and focuses it on what's called a focal plane array. If you want to think about a focal plane array, is simply like the focal plane of a camera, of one of your digital cameras. In this particular case, it would be trying to see a warhead at great range. And an example of a more realistic warhead relative to the one that is shown by General Kadish is shown in the next slide. This is a warhead that's designed to have a very, very small radar reflectivity. The features that make it very, very low reflectivity are it has a sharp nose. Turns out the nose on these warheads are a significant reflector of radar. And the back end of the radar. And notice that the back end in this vehicle is round, not flat. If you looked at the back end of the vehicle, it was not shown in the photograph that Kadish had there. It was flat. And because the back end of the radar of the warhead is flat and the nose is rounded for the warheads used in the tests, the system has a very large radar cross-section, which means it's much easier to see and track. So, and incidentally, this particular warhead can be replicated by anybody because the shape is what determines its warhead. So, for example, if you wanted to make the warhead even lower radar cross-section, you could put a little metal cap on the front of the warhead that has an absolutely sharp point. And the cap would burn off on reentry, but it would have nothing to do with the function of the warhead. So you could reduce the radar reflectivity of the warhead further. So if we look at the next slide, we get a sense of how the rigs are tested with regard, the tests are rigged with regard to the radar. The radar cross-section of the warhead that General Kadish was showing you is more like a softball rather than a basketball. So it's as big as a softball, which is pretty impressive already, very, very low radar cross-section. But the real warhead radar cross-section is more likely to be that of a marble or a golf ball. So one of the things they're already doing right from the beginning is they're making it very easy for the radar to see the object. Now, this is not only a big step up for the radar to have an object with a large radar reflectivity, but as I'll show you later, it's very easy to, since the warhead looks like, let's say, a large marble, let's say it looks like a large marble, anything that's floating around the warhead that has the radar reflectivity of a large marble will look like a credible warhead. So right away it tells you if there's debris around, radar reflecting debris around the warhead, the radar is not going to be able to tell the debris relative to the warhead. We can talk more about this in detail because some of your, there are details that I could talk about, but I don't want to fill up the time with those. I want to give people the rough shape of the situation. So let's talk about the next situation in the slide. Next slide. The next issue are decoys. Now, if somebody tells you that hitting a warhead is the big challenge, they don't know what they're talking about. The fact of the matter is finding the warhead so that you can hit it is the big demanding problem. So in this particular diagram here, I'm showing you some different objects that are, they're three spherical balloons. There's in the lower left corner, there's a cone-like object that's rigid. You can take these cones and you can stack them one on top of another and then just push them out. And so you have a whole collection of them. It's very, you know, so the cones are very, very nice for decoys. In the middle lower column, I show you an actual inflatable decoy that the United States has made. This is, if you have at home an inflatable bed, you'll notice that, you know, you can make a rugged inflatable bed for light material.
And it seems like we got him back.
Have you lost me?
Oh, there, we got you back now.
Okay. This decoy is made from very light inflatable material, and it looks exactly like a warhead. To the right of it, on the lower right, is an actual Minuteman warhead, and this is a replica of Minuteman warhead. So these are the kinds of things that the system, the GMD, would have to contend with. Now, let me take a moment and tell you a little bit more. I can take that warhead on the lower right, and I can encapsulate it in a balloon. So now when the radar, and I can put some, you know, thin metal metallic layer like on the balloons you buy for your children at the zoo, you know, which are reflecting. And the radar will just see the big balloon, won't see the warhead. So now if you then deploy a bunch of big balloons, all of which have some radar reflecting material on it, where's the warhead? How does the radar see the warhead? If you instead, as I'll show you, paint the balloon with stripes and give it a nice radiating surface, the infrared kill vehicle, the infrared homing kill vehicle, is going to see a spot in space and it's going to not know what it's looking at. So you have to know what you're looking at. And I'm going to show you that Kadish understands that, because I'm going to show you a test that was screwed up where Kadish blurts out, oh, now we can't tell what we're looking at. So here's this guy, he's on television, and he said, now we don't know what we're looking at. So I'm going to explain that to you. I'm going to show you that. So this is a lieutenant general who works for the defense of the United States. Let me reemphasize that. That's his job, is to defend us. Okay, so let me show you the next slide, because I'm going to go back to it in various forms. This is an image, an actual image taken from a kill vehicle of the complex of objects that it's supposed to encounter. In the lower of the three objects you see at the center is a rocket stage. You'll see it sometimes as the MSLS. It's the mission system launch system. It's a vehicle. It's just an upper rocket stage, which carries the decoy. I say the decoy. It can carry hundreds of decoys, but it carries the decoy and the Mach warhead. And it deploys the Mach warhead and the decoy in a pattern that's very, very, very carefully designed so the kill vehicle can see it. And I'll explain what I mean by that very shortly. The kill vehicle is essentially has a very narrow field of view. Why don't we go to slide 15? And I'll explain why that's the case. If you want to understand how the kill vehicle works and what its narrow field of view means, let's go to slide 16. Imagine you're searching for a fly that's in a room with you, and it's an annoying fly. So what you do is you take a soda straw, a real soda straw, and you look through the soda straw, and you limit your vision to looking through the soda straw, and you search for the fly. So think about trying to find and intercept a fly with this kill vehicle, given that it has the field of view of a soda straw. And let me explain to you why that's the case. If we go to the next slide, I show you the telescope. I now emphasize the telescope. And again, on the right side of the telescope in green shows you the reflecting mirror. And in the cup that's on the left side, that's got what's called the focal plane in it. Let me show you in the next slide. I just show you an image of the focal plane. Here's the focal plane. It's small. It's about a centimeter, maybe a centimeter and a half across. The silver-like object in front of you, that square, is the focal plane array. And what the focal plane array is it's an extremely exotic device that has thousands of independent infrared sensors on it. And each sensor can measure the intensity at the sensor location and form an image of the field of view of the kill vehicle. Well, the problem is, if we look at, you only can have a few pixels, that is a separate separate infrared sensors on the focal plane. For example, it looks like the initial interceptor they were using had a focal plane that was 256 elements on a side. Now, why do you need 256 and a field of view of 1 degree? Well, you need 256 elements because if you're looking, if you're 150 kilometers away from the objects you're trying to find and hit, you're only 10 seconds away from hitting them because your closing speed is 15 kilometers per second.
Wow.
So if I'm 150 kilometers away, I have 256 elements, I cannot see the kill vehicle. The kill vehicle is just a smear. So I have to get close enough to see the kill vehicle, I mean, to see the target, to see the warhead, so that I can make the final adjustment so that I can run into the, so that I can pass through the planform of the target. That's how I can hit it. So I have this competition between a field of view that I want to have to see objects that are separated and look at them and inspect them, and having to have a very narrow field of view to have the resolution to hit the target as I get close enough.
And so is this one of the comments that they made in the movie? It's like a bullet hitting a bullet. Is that what you're describing here?
Well, it's harder.
Okay. It's harder than that. That's the easy path. Got it.
I think it's harder than that. So if we look at slide 20, I just give you a sense of the of what's going on. If we're 10 kilometers away, the kill vehicle is less than a second from actually hitting the objects. So it really has no time at all to see the objects up close and to tell which object is a real object and which is a decoy or just a piece of junk. If we go back to slide, go next to slide 21, I'll remind you of the view we saw. All right, here's the view. The view contains the topmost of the three objects is a 2 meter diameter balloon, which incidentally is 10 times brighter than the warhead. And that's important because the only thing they can use to tell the warhead from the balloon is the brightness of the object. That's the only discriminant they want to call. All these other things they talk about don't work.
So let me ask you about that. That's at a snapshot, right? So
yeah, that's a snapshot.
Will these deception balloons and whatever else, do they fly along with the warhead the whole time?
Oh, yeah, it's very good you brought that up. Yes, because remember, this is in the vacuum of space, and there's no aerodynamic drag in the vacuum of space. So the balloon flies along with the warhead unchanged in its motion. So if I throw out a tissue paper next to the balloon, it's just going to fly along with the balloon. So you're going to have all this stuff floating. If you look at these astronauts when they're working on something and they have a wrench out there and it's just floating in space, and you know, it all, you know, there's no air. If there were aerodynamic drag, it would all be pulled away, of course, along with the astronaut as well. So it's the vacuum of space is a critical factor, and that makes the system unworkable because any decoy you throw out is going to fly along with the warhead.
So that's in the space. But once it enters back into the atmosphere, obviously the drag returns. Is it impossible to hit on the deception phase?
You'd have to have another system that works in the atmosphere.
So this system that you're talking about that we have, it's only to work.
It only works outside the atmosphere. Only works outside the atmosphere. There are other systems they'll claim works inside the atmosphere. I can discuss those. But they have other failure modes. But there's no interception system that works, although they have different vulnerabilities. And we do have several systems. THAAD is a system that claims to work inside the atmosphere. I could give a talk on that and show how it's completely unworkable.
One of the things you said at the beginning, you said you would tell us where this 61% number came from that the film.
We're gonna get to that. We're going to get to that. So if we go to the next slide, 22, the left three-dimensional graphic shows you the actual arrangement of the objects that you see in the image I showed you earlier. Notice that they're all pointing in the direction. The rightmost object is the MSLS. It's the upper rocket stage that deploys the decoy and the warhead. The decoy is deployed directly in the direction of the incoming kill vehicle. And the warhead is also deployed directly in the direction of the incoming vehicle. So if we look to the right, if you look at the right, this same chart, but we're now looking down the axis of the kill vehicle, you see that it looks like the image we saw in the diagram 21. Let's go back to that if we could. The balloon is in the upper left. The warhead is in the middle, slightly to the right. The rocket stage is at the bottom, slightly in the middle. So if we go to slide 22 and we look at the the image as seen from the direction of the kill vehicle, we see the image that we saw earlier. But of course, what happens if the balloon is deployed in the vertical direction and the warhead is deployed downward? Then it wouldn't be in the field of view. You wouldn't know what to point at, and you wouldn't know what you were looking at, and you wouldn't be able to see.
And we seem to have lost Ted again.
You're still there?
Well, there we go. Sorry.
Did I black out too or not?
Yeah, you kind of went to silent there for a second, but now we got you back.
You still wouldn't be able to see multiple objects if the decoy were deployed in the vertical direction and the warhead were deployed in the vertical, opposite vertical direction or any other vertical direction. They would be out of the field of view of the soda straw of the kill vehicle. So let's look at the tests that were run. So if we look at slide 23, here's the geometry of the test. In the lower left, in the green points are shown at 1 minute interval or 30 second intervals. You can see that the kill vehicle is launched from Kwajalein Island. That's the lower left side of the chart. And it's moving quite slowly. So the closing speed in this case is much lower than would actually be the case in a real test. So you have more time to see the object at, let's say, 100 kilometers range than you would in a real engagement. In a real engagement, 100 kilometers would give you maybe, two-thirds of a second or 6 or 7 seconds, whereas in this experiment, you might get 10 or 15 seconds because the closing speed is much lower. So that's point one. At the time of the launch, the sun is very low in the horizon. So the sun is heating the balloon, which is coming along in its front. So the balloon is very hot in its front surface, which is the surface facing the kill vehicle. So the kill vehicle is seeing a very bright object. If the sun were not shining, the balloon would look much dimmer. And it could actually look as dim as the warhead. Now, of course, you could make the balloon look as bright by just putting some heating elements in it. But the point of them is that even the time of day would make this experiment fail. If you would not be able to tell the warhead from the decoy. Remember, you have to know what the warhead looks like relative to the decoy. So if we look at the orientation of the object.
And sorry about that, folks. We seem to be having
next slide, Gary. If we look at slide 24, we can see the orientation of the objects. You see that on the long trajectory where the locations are shown in red, there are arrows pointing downward. What happens is in the rightmost arrow that's pointing downward, that's the direction along which the decoy and the warhead have been deployed, the line of their deployment. So what happened is when the target complex was launched, the kill vehicle did a maneuver nearly perpendicular to its direction of motion and deployed the objects along the line of sight that was going to be the line of sight when it reached the point of the engagement. So, because remember, everything is moving in the vacuum of space. So as the objects move in the vacuum of space, they stay on that along that direction. So when they arrive at the target, they're pointed right at the soda straw. If they were spread out, the soda straw would not be able to see the multiple objects.
And by the way, somebody asked this question in the comments that I had myself. Sure, how spread apart are the decoys?
Well, ordinarily. The decoys are miles apart when they actually, but you don't, they don't look miles apart. They look hundreds of meters apart because laterally they're hundreds of meters apart. In distance, they're miles apart. Let's just go back to slide 22. If you look at slide 22, the leftmost diagram shows the three-dimensional arrangement of the target and decoy and launch vehicle. See, they're spread miles apart. The distance on the bottom is miles. But if we look at the orientation, which is the same plot, but we're looking from we're looking down the barrel of the line of objects. You can see they're only spread apart by fractions of a mile. So I've arranged this. This is all, you know, we're setting up the strap down chicken so that we can chop its head off. So if we go to slide 25, we can see that I show you two alternative ways of deploying. The blue curve on that's going along the X and Y axis, that shows you the actual deployment direction. But if I deploy vertically, then as the kill vehicle gets closer, you can see the field of view, which is shown for different ranges, shown in red, the different ranges get smaller and smaller and smaller. But notice, even at a range of 300 kilometers, which is the largest square you see, you can't see both the decoy and the warhead. So you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be able to study the decoy and the warhead. So let's go to slide 26. Slide 26 is the integrated flight test number 5. This is the flight test where the shit hits the fan. Okay. Well, let's just put it. What slide 27 is showing you, this is a little difficult to see, so I put a lot of helpers on this slide. This is, if you look at the upper left most slide, you can see a little ball roughly at the center right of the slide. That's a deployed balloon being seen with a video camera that's on the vehicle that's deploying the balloon. This is from the flight test, integrated flight test 1A, where they flew a bunch of objects. They never tried to hit anything. They just flew decoys to see what they'd look like. If you look up and to the left of the balloon, you see another deployed balloon. So what they did is they deployed a bunch of balloons. Now, if we look at the right bottom corner, we can see the outline of the canister that's being used to deploy still another inflatable balloon. Okay, so what you're seeing is the canister outlined in white, and you see something coiling out. It looks almost like a caterpillar. That's the balloon being blown out of the canister. And if we go to the next slide, look at the upper left again, you can see the canister and the balloon unfolding, looking like a little bit of a caterpillar as it comes out of the canister. If we look at the middle row of images and look at the rightmost image on the middle row, you can see the balloon is starting to inflate. So the caterpillar starts looking like a balloon, starts looking like a butterfly. And then in the lower most lower right, you can see the canister attached to the balloon and the balloon at full size. Okay, now notice that the canister is very small.
Yeah.
Next to the balloon. Okay. Well, what happened in the integrated flight test 5? Well, they deployed only a balloon a warhead and the missile launch vehicle. Okay, so what happened is the canister failed to open. So you only had the canister out there, but not an inflated balloon. So what would you see if the kill vehicle were looking at this complex of objects now? Let's go to slide 29. Instead of seeing a bright 2.2 meter diameter object, you would see a dim object. You could still see it because the amazing infrared sensors can actually see these things at this range. But you, so you see three objects that are the dimmest, where the brightest object is now the dimmest object. Now, in the planned, in the rigged test, what we were expecting to see is the dimmest object would be the Mach warhead, which is the middle of the three objects, because that would be the warhead, the Mach balloon would be 10 times brighter than the Mach warhead. But now the 2.2 meter diameter balloon is 10 times less bright. It's the dimmest object. So if I'm, if I programmed the kill vehicle to home on the dimmest of the three objects, it knows nothing except the home. It's been told in advance to home on the dimmest of the object. I'll shoot it. I'll home on the wrong object. Well, this was on 60 Minutes. Unfortunately, I couldn't find the video I have of it. It's wonderful. If you guys have a great search, this was televised, this experiment. So Kadish goes gray. He's being photographed now, and he just goes gray. And the reporter says, what's the matter, General Kadish? And he blurts out, we'll see slide 30. He says, the canister didn't open. So the decoy is not going to look exactly like what we expected it to look like. So it presents a problem for the system that we didn't expect. So he's telling you that he knows that the rig test is going to fail. He's telling you that he's rigged the test, and damn it, it didn't work as I expected it, and we're going to fail. Now, it turns out that the kill vehicle did not separate, so they had a multiple failure.
Oh, man.
What?
I said, oh, goodness.
So he was really saved, but... otherwise, the balloon, the kill vehicle would have homed on the canister. Well, this is the level of fraud we're dealing with in this Missile Defense Agency, where you have a general whose job it is to provide for the defense of the United States, and he's lying to the American public about a system that's supposed to defend the country. Now, I'm limited in time, so... let me just jump to slide 32 and just call it to the attention of your audience. I won't spend any time on it, but this is a summary of tests the United States have flown with decoy arrangement, things to defeat missile defense systems. If we go to slide 33, I'll show you one of the simplest countermeasures of all. This is a Titan missile with a big warhead on it. And what we did is, if we look at slide 34, we cut the Titan missile into a bunch of, this was an actual experiment that was flown, it was secret at the time, into a bunch of objects. And if we look at slide 35, what I've done is inserted at the top an actual warhead that would be in this cluster of objects. Remember, you can't see the shape of these objects, because you don't have the resolution. The radar can't see the shape, and the infrared homing kill vehicle can't see the shape. So all you see is a cluster of objects coming at you. So that's how easily you could defeat the system. Well, let me show you the flight test number six, the FTG test number six, which is really a tremendous example of fraud. Let's go to slide 36. in this particular test, let's jump to slide 42, because I want to keep. Let me show you this. All right. So the kill vehicle is launched onto a trajectory. Now, what the collage number one shows you is the kill vehicle oriented with the rocket motor pointed in the direction of the incoming this is not the kill vehicle, of the target vehicle being pointed. It's got its rocket motor is pointed in the direction of the kill vehicle. So it's pointed at the kill vehicle. And the reason it's pointed at the kill vehicle is the rocket motor is slowing down the warhead so that the closing speed will be slower, right? So you don't have to engage the fast incoming target at full speed. So in two, what you do is you rotate the whole system around in three, so that we get to three, so that now the warhead is closest to the incoming kill vehicle. So now the kill vehicle is looking down the nose of the warhead and the deployment system. So then I spin up the system because I don't want the warhead tumbling when I deploy it. And in number five, you see I put two, because what I'm trying to demonstrate is I can deal with more than one decoy. I'm showing you how great this system is. So I deploy two small objects. Notice that these objects are very small. So they're like the canister. They're much smaller in brightness than the actual warhead. Then I flip the missile body, the deployment body, so it's vertical. So it's side on to the incoming kill vehicle. That's shown inside in the last slide down, number eight. So what I'm looking at, when the kill vehicle is looking at, it's looking at a spin-stabilized warhead, two non-credible decoys because they're much less bright, and the upper rocket stage, which is pointed perpendicular to the object, so that to the kill vehicle, so that it's tremendously brighter than it would otherwise be. So I've got a tremendously bright upper rocket stage, two tremendously dim objects that I call decoys, and a spin-stabilized warhead. Talk about a strap-down chicken test. Well, turns out the strap-down chicken wasn't cooperating. What happened, let's go to slide 44, is when the rocket motor was closed down, it went through a phenomenon called chuffing. If you look at the yellow the yellow area that I have in this slide, at 0 seconds, the rocket motor has a lot of propellant in it. We're looking down the barrel of the rocket motor. As the propellant burns, of course, the propellant burns from the inside out. So this shows you the propellant burn 30 seconds while it's still burning. It shows you as the motor continues to burn until, let's say, 58 seconds, which is the lower right of the burning, you have hot, unburnt, solid propellant in the rocket motor after the burnout, after the rocket motor has shut down. So this residual fuel in the rocket motor still is very hot. So it undergoes chuffing. There are small pieces of fuel that still combust spontaneously, and little particles of combusted material are sort of come out of the rocket motor. If I show you in slide 45, here is a picture of these small particles of burnt aluminum oxide from the rocket motor. Size. So if I look at slide 49, what I would see if I had an imaging radar like the X-band radar, which is this great radar that they have, what the warhead would look like, because I have this fantastic imaging capability, it would look like three points of signal. There would be from the nose of the warhead and from the back end of the warhead. The back end of the warhead would have not a very low signal, but this back end has a sharp back. If the back were rounded, you'd only see the nose. So keep that in mind. The radar can image, but it only images what electrically it can image. So if we look at slide 50, this is what it sees. That's what it sees. It doesn't see the shape of the warhead. So if we go to slide 51, what does it see now? Well, it sees all these little clumps of material that came out of the rocket motor.
Yeah.
Along with the rocket motor. So what does the radar do? It says, "What? I don't know what to do." And it just shuts down. So the system.
Not ideal.
So again, no, the rig test.
We're running low on time. So how do we get to the 61% number?
Okay, so this, what they do is they count up all the experiments. They choose to call as non-failures, and they say 61% of the time we destroyed a target. So that's this where the 61% comes from. 61% of the rigged experiments. Now, what they're claiming is, well, the four most recent targets we hit in these rig tests, we hit four targets. You know, we're getting better at rigging the tests.
And if you could just really real quick characterize what equals a rig test, especially in these last four. What are the conditions that
they
that make
slow down the target? They have no decoys, no interference of any kind. They make sure that the target is easy to see. It's well lit by the sun. It's very bright. There's nothing else to contend with, you know, to confuse the system, because it's extraordinarily sensitive to any kind of confusion, any even unintended, and they hit the target. It's a strapped down chicken.
And are you aware of any?
There aren't a bunch of cockroaches running around there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Are you aware of any tests that were actually conducted on what would actually be expected in an incoming ICBM? Not even tried. As far as you know,
none that can succeed at none.
Well, that's
no,
that's not
they don't helpful. Have one test. There's not one. That's why I say, if you want to make an informed guess, what I've showed you gives you the information you need for an informed guess. Would you say 61% knowing what I just told you? The adversary is not going to cooperate with you. You know that. I mean, anybody who can build an ICBM and a nuclear warhead can deploy balloons or junk or whatever they want. You know, it takes nothing.
Yeah, and we do that when in our ICBMs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we
do that. Sure, we do that. And so and in the rig tests, we inadvertently did it. we failed to do it.
Yeah,
so zero is the right number.
Got it. Before I let you go,
my hat off. Go ahead.
I want to show you something here from a Heritage Foundation study from just a year ago, where they're saying, you know, we need to do some things different. And what they said was, we must implement a space-based missile defense overlayer. A space-based layer would enable the United States to detect and destroy incoming ICBMs in the boost phase before they are exo-atmospheric and at the highest speeds, effectively denying our adversaries a viable low escalation pathway. What do you say?
Well, it shows how little these guys know. We do have a space-based system right now that can observe rockets in the boost phase. The problem is that we don't have a way of hitting the rockets in the boost phase. But we do have it right now. The space-based infrared system does that perfectly, does it with spectacular capability. It cost enough. The overruns were like a 10,000% cost overrun for that system and 1,000% delay in getting it. But when we finally got it, the system gives us all of the space-based tracking capability of systems in boost phase.
So then it seems to me that the ideal would be to hit the rocket before all the countermeasures are deployed. So on the way up, is that even technically possible?
Well, it is technically possible. My extraordinarily gifted colleague, Richard Garwin, who died just 6 months ago, a few months ago, and I designed a system that could intercept North Korean ballistic missiles. It's a very specialized system where you put the interceptors on airborne drones. And we showed that you could defend against North Korean ICBMs. The problem with that system is it would only work against North Korean ICBMs because you have to be close to the ICBM launch locations. The space-based system, the Golden Dome, is supposed to solve that problem, but it doesn't. And that's a whole other discussion, which we can go into again. It doesn't come close to solving the problem. But the system for North Korea, which is, can be done, but nobody has picked up on it. Nobody. I can't get... Well. And the American Physical Society did a study where they cooked the study and claimed falsely, and we can show this, that the system wouldn't work. So the American Physical Society lied to the American people. And that's a whole other story I'd love to tell here. I'd love to tell.
These organizations
publicly supported. I'd love to tell because this is fraud.
Okay, well, fraud, let me have you back on to talk about that and also about what could work. Even if it's just in the theoretical, because it doesn't make us any, doesn't do any good for the country to go down paths that can't work in a real life scenario and not go down the path that at least has a possibility if things can be overcome. But we're not even looking in the right direction, Golden Dome or otherwise. So we will definitely like to have you back and talk about that in the future.
Well, it doesn't do anything good for the country when educational institutions have scholars who make false statements and misrepresent themselves as experts. That's what I'd like to talk about next time, if you're up to it. Scholars misrepresenting themselves as experts. I'd love to do that if you want to. And we could talk about the organizations that are publicly supported, universities and organizations like the American Physical Society and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, misrepresenting important basic facts to the American public.
We are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring the truth. And if that's one that's being hidden, then we need to uncover it. So we'd look forward to having you back on to do that. But in any case, thank you so much for coming on to this one. This show by itself has been pretty shocking that, our capacity is a lot less than what we're claiming it's going to be. But we need to know the truth. And especially if you know what actually you can and can't do in missile defense, that should go into deciding what kind of policies you follow to make sure that those don't come in.
Absolutely. So
it's really important.
Zero is a pretty meaningful number in this case.
It really is. And an expensive one, as it turns out. But anyway, absolutely. Yeah, we'll look forward to talking about this other issues when you come back on the next time. And we look forward to that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
And we appreciate you guys as well. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't, because we are going to continue to give you this kind of information here. And your friends deserve to know something about it, too. Thank you very much, folks. And we'll see you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.